You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar. Introducing whiny-ass, teeny-baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives. That's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
It is Thursday, March 10th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Quite a night last night, ladies and gentlemen, in Madison, Wisconsin. We have a lot of sound from what took place last night, and I've collected all the reporting of just incredible what the Republicans do. And at the end of the day, I can tell you this is a function of them realizing they are up Poop's Creek without a paddle. We will get to that in just a moment. Later in the program, we'll be talking to Chris Hayes of The Nation magazine, both on what took place last night in Wisconsin and just the general lack of attention being paid by Washington to the job situation in this country. More of the plutocracy, the establishment being completely out of touch with the problems of this country. Continuing on with the theme, I got an email yesterday. Somebody saying, "Come on, please. Can we have some good news?" And I got to say, you know, it is a shame that it takes a huge raging a-hole to awaken the sensibilities of the middle class and the working class in this country. But I think this huge gaping a-hole in Wisconsin, who sits in the governor's mansion there, and I would also say his minions in the Republican Senate in Wisconsin have certainly unleashed something that I do not think can be bottled up. Just absolutely stunning. Let's start. We will start from backwards to forwards. I guess that makes sense, chronologically speaking. First off, let's just start and put this to rest. I know most of you know this. I know, and frankly, I appreciate the fact that at least these Republicans are starting to come out and really talk about what this is about. We have known from the very beginning, stripping unions of their essence, which is collective bargaining. I mean, that's what unions are for. Stripping them of their rights to collectively bargain is simply a naked attack on the economic and political power of the middle class and the working class, because unions are one of the primary means of people who are wage earners, of people who make less than $75,000 a year to organize. And the Republicans know this. And here you have Wisconsin State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald on Fox, I think it was yesterday, during the day. That's important, because what took place from this interview until, midnight last night, when I finally was told to go to bed by my wife and stop watching live video from the Madison Capitol building, this is what started that push. Scott Walker at this point had already filed his op-ed with the Wall Street Journal. And Scott Fitzgerald goes on Fox to begin to lay the groundwork as to why we're going to need help. Because everything that happened last night was an indication that the Republicans in Wisconsin know they have lost this battle. Excuse me, lost this war. They may have won a tiny battle last night, but they know they had lost the war. And this was a real WTF moment last night. And I'm not talking about Marin's podcast. I'm talking about, what are you going to do? We might as well. We got We got nothing to lose. So here is Scott Fitzgerald on the Republican propaganda wing known as Fox News. Here he is.
Well, if they flip the state Senate, which is obviously the goal with eight recalls going on right now, they can take control of the labor unions. If we win this battle and the money is not there under the auspices of the unions, certainly what you're going to find is President Obama is going to have a much more difficult time getting elected and winning the state of Wisconsin.
Ah, I see. And that will magically deal with any type of budget issues they have in Wisconsin. If Obama loses in 2012, then, of course, the Wisconsin budget automatically from the budget fairy becomes balanced. That's the way it works in Republican minds. If we can get the Kenyan socialist, the Kenyan anti-imperialist, the Manchurian candidate, if we can get him unelected in Wisconsin, then, of course, our budget is immediately balanced. No, there he is, Scott Fitzgerald, telling the world what we've been saying for weeks, that this attempt to destroy unions in Wisconsin was all about political power. And now what I'm going to play you is audio from a video that is out there that we will post on the blog after the show at majority.fm. And this is the beginning of a process that was put in place last night. There was an attempt and a successful one to strip from the budget reconciliation, the budget fixing bill, whatever Walker was calling it, all of the fiscal measures. In other words, anything that would affect the budget, oddly enough, and leave in only the aspects of destroying collective bargaining for unions. Now, the process for this, normally, and the reason why they're doing this, I should tell you right up front, is any bill that goes through the Wisconsin House and Senate that deals with fiscal matters requires a two-thirds quorum to be voted upon. Any other bill simply requires a 51% quorum. And so this is important. Now, well, you're asking yourself, why didn't they do this weeks ago? Well, that's a very good question, because I think they knew at that time it was very dubious from a legal standpoint. And why are they attempting this yesterday? Well, like I say, I think they know they're going to lose the Wisconsin Senate. I think they know Scott Walker may or may not be recalled in a year, year and a half when he's eligible for it. And so at this point, they realize we've lost this. We might as well just try and do this, what I think was a fully illegal maneuver. So the process goes like this. They want to change this bill. To do so, they need to call a conference committee meeting. In this conference committee meeting, you have, I think it's four Republicans and two Democrats. Wisconsin law says that you need 24 hours lead time to call a meeting such as this, unless there's an absolute emergency. Now, there's obviously no emergency here. They've been dealing with this for weeks. There's no emergency that would prevent them from giving notice of 24 hours. Secondly, you must also show the members of this conference committee the bill. That's simply the law in Wisconsin. What you're about to hear is the audio from that conference meeting. There are four Republicans, one Democrat. The Democrat you will hear in this, the first voice you will hear will be the chair of the conference committee. I think it's Scott Fitzgerald. And he is discussing the bill that is in front of them. During this time, until he starts to speak, the Democratic minority leader, Barca, has his hand up, and he is questioning the validity of this, in fact, this conference meeting. In this conference meeting, the video is very stunning. They are surrounded by media and some spectators that could get in. Not many. You'll hear them. So here it is. This is that meeting. You'll hear Barca say, wait, we can't do this. This is an illegal. This entire meeting is illegal. You're not even telling me what's in the bill. All right, let's play this audio.
The Legislative Council, the Legislative Reference Bureau, and the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, and have been advised that this proposal...
Okay, now stop right there. What Fitzgerald is saying is that I have checked this out, this bill that we're presenting to you now, with all of my cronies in the State House, essentially pulling what George Bush did to legalize torture. I have told our Republican lawyers in the State House, you got to sign off on this, and claim that this bill, which strips collective bargaining from unions, which reduces and cuts their pensions, has no fiscal impact on the state, even though we brought it up in the context of it helping the budget deficit. And they have signed off on it. That's what he is saying. So let's go back from the beginning. You can hear him. His voice is low because he is off mic. But then you will hear Barca stand up and say, this is completely BS.
The Legislative Council, the Legislative Reference Bureau, and the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, and have been advised that this proposal would not trigger the special quorum requirement in Article 8, Section 8 of the Wisconsin Constitution. At this time, I would move to adopt...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Wait, excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
As the conference...
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. I have a question about the open meetings rule being violated.
Take a moment!
You were not given 2 hours notice, first of all.
Step back from the event! Think about what you're doing here!
I have like a 24-hour notice here from Attorney General Van Hollen, the current Attorney General.
Let me discussion. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, Mr. Chairman, most importantly, before we even get started, obviously I'm going to want to have a summary of this bill from our Director Lane, so I understand what's in here.
It's the same bill you debated for 60 hours.
Oh, there's nothing different?
No, they just removed items from it.
They removed what?
Removed items. Nothing new.
So we can get a description of what was removed.
Nothing new.
Well, you said things were removed, Mr. Chairman. I want to know what's removed. I mean, it seems to me that the body should have, you know, our committee should know what we're voting on. I don't know what was removed.
Okay,
I need
stop
to know
for
that.
A second. So Barca is saying at this point, wait a second. We didn't get the 24-hour notice as called for by the Wisconsin open meeting rule. We didn't get even a notice of what's in this bill. And Fitzgerald says, it's the same bill as before. We just removed stuff. And so Barca says, well, you got to tell me what you removed. Because that has direct bearing on whether or not I would vote for this bill. I mean, presumably, if they took out the part about collective bargaining, Barca would have voted for this bill. Or very possibly. I mean, we just don't know. We don't know what's in the bill, and there is speculation now that, in fact, they didn't remove anything from the bill. Nobody knows because nobody saw the bill. Barca continues.
So I do want a description from Director Lane. Secondly, I have a couple of motions I would like to make as amendments to this. Clearly, conference committees, you know, do have an opportunity for people to amend the bill. So I want to be able to present those. But before we even get into that, I want to say that this is a violation of the open meetings law. It is required, I got a memo here from our current Attorney General, not a past one, the current one, August of 2010. The attorney, no Wisconsin court decision will allow meetings unless you have good cause to provide less than 24 hours notice of a meeting. The provision, like all other provisions of the open meetings laws, must be construed in favor of providing the public with the fullness and most complete information about government affairs that's compatible with the conduct of government business. If there's any, listen, it says if there's any doubt as to whether good cause exists, the governmental body should provide 24 hours notice. This is clearly a violation of the open meetings law. Now, if you've been shutting people down, it is improper for you to move forward while this is a violation of the open meetings law. You're not allowing amendments, and that is wrong. Now, I, Mr. Chairman, this is a violation of law. This is not just a rule, it is the law. There must be... No, Mr. Chairman, this is a violation of the open meetings law. It requires 24 weeks, 2 hours.
What have you done?
Okay.
What have you done?
Shame!
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 What have you done? What have you done?
So you can hear there, as Barca is saying this is a violation of the open meetings law, Fitzgerald is actually taking a vote. You hear his gavel hit. They get up and start to walk out of the room while Barca is yelling, this is a violation of the law. And they make their way out to the room erupting. At this point, what happens is people begin to storm into the Wisconsin Capitol building. And you can hear, this is the audio from the rotunda following the vote.
Hi there, I want to give you a look at the Capitol Rotunda right now. This is about 8:30 tonight. The Capitol building has been closed. All official business done for today. But this is what the rotunda looks like right now. Thousands of people have made their way into the Capitol building through breaches in state Capitol doors. Police officers who were guarding some of these doors simply retreated because doors had pushed open. We do know that some windows have been broken. People have been coming in bathroom doors. But there are thousands of people packing this building right now. It's unclear what's going to happen. They're asking for people's cooperation to leave. But clearly, as you can see, it doesn't look like any of them will be anytime soon.
And let's just play this audio. Not only were there thousands of people who had stormed into the Wisconsin Capitol building, but we also have audio of cars driving around the Capitol building, honking to, well, it's what they're honking is, this is what democracy looks like. So there you have it. Just an incredible scene last night at the Wisconsin Capitol building. Today, the General Assembly will vote on that bill that was passed by the Senate last night following that conference meeting you just heard the sound of. And after we talk to Chris Hayes about this and more, we will discuss the legal implications of what happened last night and what we expect to happen in the coming days in Wisconsin, as well as some other stories, obviously, that are in the news today. Representative Peter King, the pro-IRA terrorist, I guess the IRA terrorist supporter, is now looking into the Muslim community in this country. My understanding is that Keith Ellison just spoke about an hour ago in front of this committee hearing and gave a very moving speech. But when we come back, we'll be talking to Chris Hayes. All right, we are back on the Majority Report on the phone. Chris Hayes from The Nation magazine and other outlets, you're all familiar with him. I imagine I'd be shocked if you weren't. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Sam.
So, you know, obviously this was fortuitous. Your piece on in The Nation magazine about why Washington is so out of touch with the plight of Americans who are looking for jobs, finishes with, and this is from, I guess, last week, frankly, finishes with a mention of what was going on in Wisconsin. And, of course, the stuff in Wisconsin last night was pretty crazy. But let's start with this idea of why Washington is so out of touch with the job situation in this country.
Well, I say in the piece there's two reasons, I think, two numbers. One is the unemployment rate among those with a four-year college education, which is currently 4.2%, which by historical standards is fairly low. In fact, is pretty close to full employment. And in the world of people in which everyone they know has a four-year college degree, they have a four-year college degree, particularly younger people, I think, because the unemployment rate is higher for older workers. I mean, young, not right out of college, because it's very high for people right out of college. But all of that said, you have a situation in which for a certain sector of the country, and it's the sector of the country that staffs Congress, staffs the Hill, staffs the White House, is involved in the kind of beltway policymaking apparatuses, you know, the recovery really has happened. And then you look geographically, and Washington has the lowest unemployment rate of any metro area in the country, 5.5%, and added more jobs than any other metro area in the country. So there's actually just a kind of geographic immediacy to this, and that if you live in Washington, walk around Washington, particularly the sort of white affluent parts of Washington, not Anacostia and Southeast, it feels like it's back in the mid-2000s. There's new restaurants opening. And I think there was a moment there in the wake of when the crisis was at its most brutal in that fall of 2008. There was a moment where it really did feel like we were all subject to it, where everyone sort of knew people that were losing jobs, I think all the way up the income scale and across the country geographically.
Right. We heard those stories of people going into Hermes and wanting to leave with a brown paper bag so that they weren't being too ostentatious. They had consciousness. An embarrassment on some level.
Right.
An awareness that there were people hurting. But the awareness came from the fact that they knew there were people hurting as they walked up Madison Avenue on 75th Street and North, as opposed to and nobody's walking on 75th Street in Madison unless they're shopping at these stores.
Right. Exactly. And I think the issue right now is that this recovery. So I think the point, I mean, some people responded and said, well, you know, I don't really think it's this geographic thing. And I think actually the geographic aspect of it to it is secondary to the kind of class socioeducational aspect of it. You had a country that was deeply divided along sort of class lines in terms of levels of employment and wage stagnation and wealth accrual before the crisis. What you've seen is the crisis has exacerbated those trends. So these two continents, the two Americas, have, by this sort of seismic disruption, been pushed further and further apart. And there is more right now, there's really more truth to the two Americas notion than there was even before the crisis, and there was a lot of truth to it before then.
Right.
And I think it ends up posing a kind of fundamental, when you get enough, I use the term social distance, which I didn't coin, other people have used it. There's a great paper by a law professor named Brescia from SUNY Albany, who has a paper called Social Distance and the Foreclosure Crisis. And, you know, social distance is just the basic notion of how the kind of polity, how fractured we are along these very different lines. And I think there's only so much social distance a sort of representative democracy can take before you really start getting problems, fundamental core problems of representation.
And you know, you cite in this piece, which was quite coincidental because we spoke to Lawrence Lessig yesterday. But you cited a study by Princeton political scientist Martin Gillens, I guess,
yep.
Who looked at the over the course of a 20-year period of time, the difference between public opinion and policy outcomes. And he found that, quote, when Americans with different income levels differ in their policy preferences, actual policy outcomes strongly reflect the preferences of the most affluent, but bear little relationship to the preference of poor or middle income Americans. And if you were to break that down in terms of actual numbers of people, you would actually be saying the number of the policy outcome preferences of 10% of the country,
yes,
outweigh right. those of 90% of the country. And this was the argument that Lessig is making. his solutions, we could touch on. But what we're talking about is the notion that we have a plutocracy in this country, actually being sort of the Band-Aid ripped off the wound here, so to speak. The Band-Aid being this notion that everybody was flush with real estate valuations and whatnot, and everybody thought they had more money than they actually did because of this bubble. And now it's been ripped off, and now we're seeing what happens when this wound hits, when oxygen hits this wound.
That's right. And one way I think of thinking about this in the kind of long the sort of long view, you know, one of the ways to think about the New Deal was a pact that was sort of struck between between the government and big business and capital, which was that capital would essentially be reined in certain ways in exchange for the government helping to provide demand. So that sort of Keynesian pact was, you know, we're going to provide demand so that there's customers, and that's going to end up benefiting you. And this was, it wasn't like they like went willingly into this, but this was sort of the nature of the pact. What happened in the sort of post 1970s was that demand was replaced with credit. So instead of wage increases, what you got was credit increases. And what we've seen at the end of the end of the sort of final financial speculative bubble was the destruction of that credit bubble. When credit is taken away and wages are still stagnant, people don't have much money. And so you see this, it's brought into stark relief, the gap between, you know, working people, broadly construed, and people that have more means, have more education, and have more social capital.
It's interesting because that pact, you could also argue, was the same pact that was made, in terms of healthcare reform. Mm-hmm. We will provide you. We're going to limit certain things on your end in terms of the.
We'll
industry,
provide you customers.
We're
exactly.
going to provide you customers.
Yep.
And you know, I was talking to Chris Hedges about his book last week, and he also discusses that the New Deal in the context of it was also sort of a it was also to I guess let some of the air out of the tires of a building pressure on capital in this country, and in some ways was used as a way of preventing this country from going full on socialist at that time, and that that was sort of the way to let some of the air out of the tires to provide some type of short for the fuse. And when you talk about it in terms of the credit running out, we're at one of those periods again, presumably, where we see, you know, on one side the Tea Partiers talking that could end up being some Smedley Butler situation.
Nice Smedley Butler reference.
And on the other side, we're seeing what's happening in Wisconsin.
I think there's two ways of viewing the Tea Party, roughly construed on the left. One is as sort of fundamentally and existentially reactionary to their core and kind of unassimilatable, and the other is as sort of people who's they're disgruntled with the same status quo we are, and it's being channeled and marshaled by demagogues in sort of reactionary directions. And I myself actually vacillate between these two poles, sort of depending on the day and depending on what the latest thing is. But I do think that one of the things, and this is something I sort of write about in the book I'm working on now, is that if you look at the Netroots and MoveOn, and look at the Tea Party, and look at their socioeconomic sort of core, demographic core. They're different in many ways. One is much more racially diverse and younger than the other. But if you look at income levels, they're both sort of their sort of income level core is sort of the upper middle class. And one of the things we've noticed that's happened is the real inequality upwards redistribution that's happened, particularly in the last 10 years, hasn't been from the poor all the way up, because the poor already were sort of taken out a decade before and two decades before. The real redistribution has happened in the top 1% pulling away from the 99 and the top 10 pulling away from the 90. And the place where this is felt most is in the second quintile. So that's people that between 40 and 20%. Of 40th and 20th percentile of income. And that actually, I think, much of the kind of class politics that's channeled through both the Netroots and MoveOn and the Tea Party, and I'm not trying to equate them because I think there's obviously massively different substantive visions of the future, but I do think there's something about that's the place where this, the notion that there.
Nope, we just, Chris, we just.
People getting ahead and getting ill-gotten gains.
We're having a little bit of tech issue. Hold on for 1 second. Bear with us for 1 second.
Sure.
How do I get rid of the video?
Hey, we back?
Yeah, we're back. Sorry.
Sorry about that. I think it's on my end. My internet connection is has not been the greatest. Anyway, a long way of saying that I think that actually the dynamics of sort of plutocracy and increasing inequality. Hello?
Yep. Are you there? Yeah. Okay, I just great. Got rid of the video.
Okay. The dynamics of plutocracy and increasing inequality. Are because the society is so stratified, because it's a sort of like M.C. Escher-esque Tower of Babel that sort of recedes infinitely upwards, that actually the places on that social structure that sort of see the inequality rise the most are actually ones that are relatively near the top.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. And that quintile, interestingly enough, is the one that's right on the cusp of needing Social Security. We have 60% of the country, the bottom three quintiles, that rely on Social Security for over 50% of their income. Then we have one quintile, the top quintile, which, you know, you could take away their Social Security times 10 and they wouldn't even notice it.
Right.
It's that quintile that is going to need Social Security more and is most, you know, sorry, I think probably most skeptical of its existence at that time, just coincidentally. But I also think that, you know, you bring up a good point about the Tea Party in this sense, because when we see stuff like what Representative King is doing today, when we see the inflaming of racial issues and that, I think that is I think to a certain extent that's by design to make sure that those, to the extent that there are elements of the Tea Party that are mad at corporate excesses, that are frustrated by this income situation, it is to make sure that those, they're sequestered from somehow meeting in the middle. And I can't help but wonder, you know, when I start to see more and more reports, particularly of like firemen and cops, mm-hmm. in yeah. Wisconsin, despite the fact that they've not been targeted by Scott Walker, coming yeah. out, and you keep hearing these anecdotal stories of firemen going like, I haven't voted, you know, Democrat because of the hippies,
right.
you know, but I'm seeing a different side of the Republican Party.
Yep.
This could be the beginning of that type of coalition, almost some of those Reagan Democrats. As they retain the vestiges of their parents' problem with hippies and blacks and gays, sort yep. of fade away, but they get back to that root core of this is sort of a blue-collar issue in some level, or a gray-collar issue.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think that's I think, you know, the solidarity you've seen on the part of police and firefighters has been really inspiring and promising, because, you know, Walker made an incredibly, I mean, just almost preposterously cynical calculation in exempting them from the bill, which of course has no conceptual or fiscal justification. It was sheer politics. And so I think for them not to be kind of suckered by that and actually to stand with their brothers and sisters who are sort of under the gun, is extremely promising. And also, you know, again, shows the importance of unions. And part of the things that unions can forge is solidarity across sort of, you know, when unions are their best, they're sort of, they're broadening people's conception of who they are, who is on their side and,
right.
and on whose side they should be. When they're at their worst, they're sort of at their most kind of narrowly pursuing, interests for just their small core of members, which again, you know, everyone does that. And there's a certain degree to which that's part of their reason for being. But unionism in the kind of broad historical and I think almost sort of sublime sense is all about stretching past whatever the kind of boundaries are that have been inscribed by profession or sort of education, legal divisions, et cetera.
Let me turn to Wisconsin just a little bit more specifically. Is Scott Walker the dumbest politician in America?
Well, it's funny, you know, I mean, I go back and forth on this as well, because at a certain level, he's played this terribly. There was a deal on the table that, you know, he could have just struck out the collective bargaining aspects of this, gotten the givebacks he wanted, and kind of looked reasonable and actually, in a certain sense, won, right? I mean, he asked for, you know, you ask for $100 and you get 80. It's not bad from a negotiating standpoint. I mean, I think that, you know, I think he, from what I've been talking to some people, you know, he was the county executive
right.
in Milwaukee before this. And I've talked to a bunch of people from Milwaukee who sort of interacted with him, teachers union folks there. You know, he's a true believer. You know, I mean, you know,
but I'm talking like, I don't doubt he's a true believer about this stuff. But I mean, you know, what happens to all of this if he doesn't announce almost simultaneous with his desire to destroy collective bargaining that he's prepared to bring out the National Guard?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You know, that was the story that everybody talked about on the first days
yep.
outside of Wisconsin. And then he goes on and on and on. They've handled this so poorly. I mean, I am excited about what he has ignited on the left. And at the same time, I just lament the fact that it takes this big of an a-hole and a moron
yep.
in terms of political skill to do it.
Right. Well, but that's, I mean, I think that part of that is, you know, there's certain, it's interesting how much this has resonated. And I think partly it's the place because obviously this is actually the birthplace of public sector unionism, and also has this just tremendous, amazing labor history. The state of Wisconsin has a kind of deep progressive strain that stays in that state, that's kind of palpable in the state, particularly in the city of Madison,
right.
which is where he picked the fight, which is sort of the funniest part of it. I mean, that really is like, you know, it would be like, you know, if the governor of Alabama came out and said, tomorrow we're mandating gay marriage for everyone, you
right,
know,
right,
I mean,
right.
there'd be a lot of people on his doorstep the next day. I mean,
right.
it's sort of in the heart of liberalism in the city of Madison. So I think there's, you know, I think he's misplayed it. At the end of the day, I'm really curious now what comes next after the kind of power grab last night, in which they basically, I mean, what's so funny, I don't know if you've talked about this yet today, but what's so funny about last night, right, is that the state constitution requires a quorum for any fiscal bill that has sort of pertains to fiscal matters. And so the whole story, of course, was that collective bargaining rights and reducing them and crushing them was actually a fiscal matter. And as long as they were saying that, then they had a quorum. But of course, it never really was a fiscal matter.
Right.
And so last night, they finally threw in the towel, basically said, yes, we were lying the whole time. This isn't actually fiscal. They took out the parts that are collective bargaining and they passed that without a quorum.
Yeah. You know, I have two theories about why the timing now. Is that one, I think they realize we have lost this war, and we're going to lose the Senate. There's a very good chance we're going to lose the Senate within 60 to 80 days whenever these recalls can take place. And on top of that, I think the other element that they know there are a lot of different legal questions surrounding this, not just in terms of the process, because there's clearly a lot of legal questions in terms of the process, but the idea that the issues of home rule that they can mandate to cities and towns and counties how they handle their negotiations with their employees. And I think all this is going to end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And this election, there is an election for the Wisconsin Supreme Court that is happening in less than 1 month from today.
Yep.
And
yep.
I think they wanted to maybe get this and try and fast track it to the Supreme Court in Wisconsin before they know they have a very good chance of losing that. Right now they hold it 4-3. And, you know, this is going to pour money into this race, and I gotta believe there's gonna be a lot more Democratic money coming in, and they could very well lose the Supreme Court where all of this stuff is gonna end up, and that's just gonna put all of this to bed.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing is that my understanding is that there's, you know, there is some open question about whether they sort of did what they had to do procedurally. There's an open meetings provision of the state constitution, or it might be statutory. I don't know if it's constitutional or statutory, but there's a requirement that you have 2 hours notice for meetings, and they announced the 6 p.m. meeting yesterday after 4 o'clock. So they were in violation of that. I mean, there's going to be a lot of things, I think, to litigate about it. And yeah, it's going to end up in front of the state Supreme Court.
Well, and go ahead.
Yeah. No, you go ahead.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see where this turns out. And of course, there's rallies across the state today. You've got students, high school students, supposedly, at least in Wisconsin, but I'm hearing, like, yep, you know, reports that it may be happening around the country, are simply going to walk out of their classes at 2 p.m. today, wherever 2 p.m. falls, in their part of the country. And there's even talks of wildcat strikes, general strikes, in Wisconsin and in across the country. It's going to be fascinating to see. And I think on Saturday, it's going to be crazy there.
Yeah, I think it's going to be crazy there. And I think, you know, one of the things I think that's interesting, one of the things I really like, or I found sort of both inspiring politically in terms of my own ideological commitments and dispositions, but also fascinating as a political reporter, is that what's happened in Wisconsin has reminded us in a real immediate way that politics is a thing much larger and more creative and more unpredictable than the kind of dreary hand-to-hand combat that happens in legislative chambers that we saw a year of the healthcare bill being hashed out, which is not to say that that isn't important too, because a functioning democracy, you know, has to have these sort of procedures and institutions that channel legislation and have competing interest balance, et cetera. But, you know, the moments of real kind of progress and national uplift that have happened, you know, have happened, if you look at the suffrage movement, if you look at civil rights, they started outside the legislative chambers. They started in these ways that were creative expressions of resistance, you know, creative and sort of unpredictable visions of how to call to account those in power, whether it was hunger strikes that the suffragists had outside the White House for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time, whether it was the bus boycott in Montgomery, which required just an almost unfathomable level of logistical expertise to pull off, to get people to work, to sort of run the carpools. And there's amazing sections in the Taylor Branch trilogy about just how difficult it was to make the bus boycott work day after day. You saw in dispatches from Tahrir Square that there was a impromptu daycare, kind of kindergarten, that was set up in the square so people could bring their kids there. And there was actually an impromptu daycare set up inside the Madison Capitol during this sort of quote unquote occupation. So all of this reminds us that what we are capable of as sort of human beings and as political entities is at certain moments, you know, far more expansive and humane and beautiful than what our political institutions in any one moment can reduce us to.
Great point. Great place to end it. Chris Hayes, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was great.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Be well, man.
All right, folks, there you have it. We are far more empowered than we may often think. And, you know, sometimes it takes... still contend that sometimes it's a shame that sometimes it takes just a huge a-hole I'm not going to carry out the metaphor. There's no point in that. We'll take a quick break. I'm going to come back with just a couple more points about Wisconsin before we go to the flip side. We'll be right back after this. All right, we're back. So just to recap what happens next, the assembly in Wisconsin will be dealing with that bill today, this morning, if they haven't already. That will pass because the bill in the past passed, and they don't even need the quorum requirements that they needed last time. Now all they need is a halfway quorum. The legal challenges, as outlined by David Dayan, One is the potential for the open of the violation of the open meeting laws, which we played that sound from you earlier in the program, and Hayes referenced. So that could be one issue that is challenged. There are other statutes about collective bargaining that may be brought up in court and fought, like I mentioned, the home rule. There's the issue of having a bill having a fiscal impact. So if there is indeed, aside from what took place in the conference meeting, if the vote that was that took place by the Wisconsin Senate was even legitimate because of what was inside the bill. And again, we don't even know what was inside that bill. They never showed it to anybody. And then, of course, there's the Supreme Court fight, which I had mentioned at the end of the conversation with Hayes, and the recalls that are certainly going to take place that, you know, at this point, if I'm one of those Republican senators who's on that list of eight to be recalled, I would be scheduling a week-long vacation after that vote because I'm not going to survive. I'm not going to survive. And apparently, also from David Dayen, that Barca, the Democratic Senate minority leader in the state house in Wisconsin, collected signatures from witnesses right after that conference meeting to prepare to file a legal challenge to that conference meeting. So it's fascinating. There's all sorts of different issues that are going on there. It will take a while for this bill to be implemented. And like I say, I think a lot of it has to do with there is going to be a push to fast track it into the Supreme Court dominated by Republicans today. But I would imagine this Supreme Court that's dominated by Republicans today after the election on April 4th will not be dominated by Republicans. It will flip 4-3 Democratic. So stunning situation there. And more important, I do think, is what happens today, what happens tomorrow, what happens Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and so on in terms of the people power that are outside of the state house there. Because, you know, I know they're scared in the state capital of Wisconsin. And I imagine at one point, if this continues, they will be scared in different state houses and, more importantly, in Congress. It's just... It's just extremely exciting, very inspirational. I have half mind to just try and go out there, frankly, if I can figure out a way of doing so. Can somebody get Soros on the line, see if he can send a private jet for me to fly out there? I actually checked, flight... like prices last night. It's like $450 or something. That is it's 45 new members. I'll tell you what.
Go. Everybody just go.
I'll tell you what. If we get 45 new members today, I will go. If we get 45 new members in the next couple hours... Now, a lot of people listen by podcast, but...
I'll defer my monthly wage.
Yeah, that's not fair. You know, you're not even... We'll talk about that ever. Dorsey. Son of a bitch. Dorsey may not be with us much longer. And not because of that, I'm going to fire him. Dorsey. All right, well, we'll save that for next week. But... Dorsey may have found greener pastures. And I got news for you, folks. It's not hard to, find greener pastures, even in this season. Just to give you a brief roundup of what's happening around the country. In Oklahoma City, hundreds of Oklahoma firefighters are rallying at the state capitol yesterday, marching to try and save their pensions as the as they're trying to undercut their collective bargaining and their pensions in Oklahoma. In Michigan, Rachel Maddow and Naomi Klein, yesterday, I guess it was, talked about the plan in Michigan to starve the budget for cities and towns, then unilaterally declare a state of emergency for these towns, insert their own town manager, unelected, kill any contract the town entered. This is like a forced bankruptcy under the auspices of a state of emergency, so that they can crush their contracts with their unions. I mean, it's just such a bizarre thing to be talking about. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire and other states around the country, but particularly New Hampshire, the Republicans are trying to disallow students who live in their state for 9 to 10 months out of the year from voting there. They're trying to strip college kids of their rights because, as the New Hampshire Republican House state speaker said, college kids and how they vote are, quote, unquote, foolish. Voting as a liberal, that's what kids do. Students lack, quote, life experience, and they just vote their feelings. Incidentally, that's also how 18-year-olds shoot a gun in Iraq and Afghanistan. They feel like they're going to die, so they shoot another human being. There's more of these shenanigans going on across the country. North Carolina trying to disenfranchise black people by imposing rules on ID, which they know that it's 25% of black people in North Carolina don't have the type of ID they're demanding. Meanwhile, Idaho's legislator on Tuesday passed a bill again, stripping collective bargaining rights from the state's unionized teachers. So it's happening across the country, and the question is, how much are you going to stand for, folks? How much are you going to stand for? That's the question. In Wisconsin, all those Republicans are going to be voted out in 2012, if they're not voted out before then. Lawyer Matthew sends me a link to 538.com, but we talked about this the other day when we had that Pew poll. There was something like 10 percentage points of people who came out and voted for Obama in 2008 that didn't show up in 2010, and 538 has numbers on labor. A lot of labor sat at home in 2010, too. It's not going to be the case in Wisconsin in 2012, folks. What about in your state? All right. Shoot me an IM on the flip side. Heck, forget 45. If we get 25 new members, today, I'm gone. I'm going to Wisconsin. I'll go. I'll figure out the details and I'll negotiate this with the state house that lives in my house, my apartment. I'll negotiate this with the governor and the... Yeah. I'm going to strict allowance, folks. That needs to pass. I'm on an austerity program at home. I'm going to have to see if I can get this through the both houses of the legislature in my house. I have been completely stripped of not just collective, but all bargaining rights in the house. So, but if I come back and I can say, look, revenue is up. These people joined specifically to send me to Wisconsin. What do you want me to do? I got to go. All right, folks, you can IM me at Majority FM. See you on the flip side.